Thank you. So we're about the halfway point. So I want to switch over now to a research piece that one of our researchers, Jaden, did, and give her the floor to talk about some of the national ramifications of the issue for a minute. So we'll go over to Jaden now.
Jaden Brayboys, and as previously mentioned, orphan wells present major issues not only in Texas, but nationwide as well. The United States is grappling with a concerning abundance of orphan wells, posing both environmental and community hazards. In a journal article published by Resources for the Future, an independent nonprofit research institution that studied over 80,000 orphan wells across the U.S., unearthed that 4.6 million people live within 1 kilometer of a documented orphan well. While not all states struggle with this issue equally, the top five highest producing states of orphan wells are Ohio with over 20,000, Pennsylvania with over 18,000, Oklahoma with over 15,000, Kentucky with over 13,000, and lastly New York with over 7,000 as of 2022. The health effects stemming from these wells are substantial. Unlike the occupational hazards experienced by upwards of 150,000 oil well workers in the U.S., a significant portion of the aftermath affects local communities and individuals instead of those employed in the oil and gas industry. Many unplugged wells excrete harmful chemicals, one being a colorless gas called benzene. According to the CDC, it has been determined that benzene causes cancer in humans. Long-term exposure to high levels of benzene in the air can cause leukemia, cancer of blood-forming organs. Further, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency classifies benzene as a known human carcinogen for every route of exposure, whether inhaled, ingested, or absorbed through the skin. And the World Health Organization has concluded that no safe level of exposure to benzene exists. Benzene is also known to cause damage to the nervous, immune, and respiratory systems. We observe that there is publicly available data illustrating the detrimental consequences of benzene emissions from abandoned wells. Yet there appears to be a lack of significant effort to mitigate further risks for communities residing in close proximity to these wells. A research study performed by the American Chemical Society in western Pennsylvania, just about 80 miles northeast of Pittsburgh, gathered data on 48 orphaned wells. The results display that there were volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, being released into the atmosphere. Physicians, scientists, and engineers for Healthy Energy measured that many of these wells were releasing benzene at concentrations as high as 250 parts per million. For reference, that is 250,000 times the permitted exposure limit in the state of California due to health and safety standards. More information about this particular instance is published on the Inside Climate News website. So now we know that orphan wells are highly toxic to people, but what about the environment? As we've discussed, orphan wells emit many toxic chemicals into the environment, methane being one of them. The ongoing release of excessive methane emissions into the atmosphere perpetuates the presence of undesirable greenhouse gases, which stand as one of the foremost drivers of climate change, a situation we aim to avoid. In addition to contributing to greenhouse gas emissions, unplugged wells contribute to contaminating our underground water supply. A statement published by the Texas Groundwater Protection Committee states, "Abandoned wells are a threat to water and public safety. Abandoned wells provide a direct channel for contaminants to pollute the aquifer below. The introduction of these chemicals into the groundwater is currently having adverse effects on both the environment and public health." Land disturbance is another significant issue that can be linked to orphan wells. The infrastructure associated with oil and gas wells, including access roads and well pads, can disrupt natural landscapes and habitats. In an article by Matthew Morin, professor of biology at Hendricks College, he explained that restoring these lands could remove millions of tons of carbon from the atmosphere as vegetation regrows on them, providing an estimated $7 billion in benefit from reduced greenhouse gas emissions. It also would provide a habitat for wildlife and could produce timber for harvesting. And because healthy ecosystems filter air and water, returning these lands to a natural state could reduce air pollution and improve drinking water quality. Initiating the restoration of these lands previously impacted by oil wells can help alleviate some of the adverse effects impacting ecosystems inhabiting the area, while also enabling the land to undergo a cleansing process to remove the long-standing toxicity it has harbored. So what are states doing to rectify this issue? Some states are receiving grant money to help cover the cost of plugging these orphan wells. For instance, as of 2021, 26 states qualified for a $25 million grant, according to E&E News. However, the study titled Environmental Risks and Opportunities of Orphan Oil and Gas Wells in the United States provides valuable insight into the magnitude of the effort required to seal these abandoned wells. There are 130,000 documented orphan wells in the U.S. This study states that it will cost somewhere between $6.3 and $8.4 billion to plug all of the orphan wells properly. Given this information, we can see that the grant money states are receiving is really only going to scratch the surface on the actual cost of fulfilling the goal of eliminating orphan wells. Nonetheless, in addition to federal funding, some states are trying to implement more regulations for the drilling of oil wells, and in recent years, well plugging programs have increased in popularity to help reduce the environmental and health implication of these wells. From our observation, the problem of abandoned wells is multifaceted, affecting numerous essential resources. Nevertheless, there is optimism that through environmental initiatives and government support in covering well-plugging expenses, we can anticipate improved land quality, ecosystem health, and community well-being in the vicinity of abandoned wells in the near future.
Thanks, Jaden. And so, one of the things that I think that really brings up for me is thinking about the unequal distribution of these things, which is something we talk about a lot, is who is most in proximity to this. Native American communities are more than twice as likely to be near an orphaned or abandoned well than other populations. Certainly, as you mentioned in the Houston map that I saw this morning, Baytown, which has historically been a site of a lot of, you know, the kind of worst environmental effects of the city. And so one of the things that I want to think about is, if you want to bring this in, is both the human toll. And I know, Amanda, in particular, you've been out and you've met with people who this directly impacts. And if you can just talk about, you know, some of the stories you've heard or things that you've seen, but also who are the communities that are most affected by this as an issue?
You know, I don't know if I am qualified to say who has been most affected. I think that the ranchers in West Texas, ranchers by nature are paying attention to what's going on their property, and they are inclined to protect their property because it's their source of income. I think arguably they are more inclined than, say, a residential owner to notice and say something. I did speak to one woman who did not know that she had orphan wells on her property until they started spewing salty water. So there are people out there who may be living on top of wells that they don't know they are, and there are people out there who know but don't know what the impacts could be. I think this is a story that's still unfolding.
No, for sure, and I think that's, you know, actually was something I wanted to bring up, is this idea of it can be on your property and not knowing. There was a push for a bill a few years back to directly write that into deeds, that if there's a well on your property, it would be there. It failed. And so there have been efforts previously to really make it where, no, people shouldn't be unaware of what's on their own land, that there is this risk. And yet, exactly, I mean, it's exactly the story you've just told, that people... It's a kind of incredible to think about that idea, but that there could be one in your probably very large backyard if we're talking about West Texas. But right. Yeah,
Paige, I don't know if you have any opinions, but
I mean, I think the issue of orphan wells and the issue of sort of problems in the field, in the oil and gas field in general, is pretty broad, right? We have a very big range. We have a big state. We have oil and gas development all across the state, and we have a wide range of constituencies there. We are definitely seeing ranchers and people in West Texas who have properties that are seeing wells that they never knew existed. We're seeing folks down along the border in drilling communities that are, you know, being impacted by waste pit permits and injection wells. And, you know, these injection wells, I think some of the bigger problem is that, you know, they're not just doing CO2 enhanced soil recovery. They're doing wastewater injection, and they're taking a lot of the, you know, wastewater and produced water from, you know, hydraulic fracturing and other drilling operations and injecting millions of barrels of wastewater every day. I mean, it's the magnitude of this injection is pretty unfathomable, which is why we're seeing problems with induced seismicity and all of the earthquakes and the geysers and the sinkholes and the well blowouts in the Permian Basin. So, you know, some of those Very rural communities are very poor. Historically, you know, in the environmental justice field, you see that these sorts of environmental blights happen in communities of color and low income very consistently across the board. And so I would recommend anybody who's really interested in this to take a look at the orphan well map that's in Amanda's article, which I think is fantastic, and also look at EJ Screen. It's a tool of the Environmental Protection Agency where you can filter based on different types of environmental hazards and different population demographics to see who's really being impacted by what, to give yourself some perspective of the issues.
Absolutely. EJ Screen is a wonderful tool for a wide range of environmental issues and concerns, and manages to terrify me every time I pop my address into there. I think it's very well worth knowing what things we're most at risk for in our own neighborhoods, yeah. and simply by where we call home. Which is absolutely, yeah, thank you for bringing that up.
Well, and I think it's really easy to use as well. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of these things, these big data sets and big tools, can feel overwhelming, and the magnitude of the problems can feel overwhelming, but EJ Screen is really easy, and especially if you're like a map geek like I am, just go in there and have fun with it. I mean, it'll give you something to work towards, you know, there's plenty of work to do here.
Absolutely, no, and it's color coded, so it's very mm-hmm. easy to figure out. Oh, I'm in the red zone. That's not good. It is definitely an easier mapping tool to read into. Paige, I want to go back for a minute because you're talking about all these various related effects. But you had also mentioned on injection drilling, and can you talk about that some and how you're seeing that as contributing to this or potentially intensifying certain effects?
Yeah. So injection wells, you know, there's a couple different types of injection wells under the EPA's Environmental Underground Injection Control Program. And Class 2 injection wells, the Railroad Commission of Texas has primacy or primary permitting authority over Class 2 wells. So that means they can permit as many injection wells as they want. And these injection wells are oftentimes for enhanced oil recovery or wastewater disposal. And there's a lot of wastewater permits coming online. We're seeing a lot of competition in the wastewater industry of kind of vying to stop the other person's permit so you can have a better share of the market. We're seeing wastewater companies making donations to the commissioners on the magnitude of hundreds of, thousands and thousands of dollars. And so the wastewater disposal industry is pretty huge and pretty relevant. But it's causing a lot of problems, right? It's causing that induced seismicity. We're seeing earthquakes in West Texas like we never, ever did before. There's an entire regional governing body that looks at regional induced seismicity. It's Texas, Oklahoma, and I think New Mexico. Because what we're putting a lot more fluids and stuff in the ground than we kind of took out, and that you know, messing with the pressure and changing the composition of the subsurface is going to have consequences, right? So Class 2 injection wells are already having a lot of problems. We're seeing the majority of the well blowouts and induced seismicity and sinkholes as related to Class 2 injection wells. And so we're really trying to point to the problems in this program to prevent the State Railroad Commission from getting any more authority. There's a new type of injection well coming out, new online by the EPA, called Class 6 for long-term carbon dioxide sequestration. And these wells are going to be much bigger, much deeper, hold much higher volumes at higher pressure of CO2. And
so this is us putting CO2 back into the ground.
Back into the ground, yeah. This is part of the sort of carbon capture and carbon management industry, climate mitigation strategy as part of the Inflation Reduction Act and the infrastructure IIJA, also known as a bipartisan infrastructure law, all have billions of dollars to subsidize carbon capture, hydrogen, and other sort of low carbon technologies. One of which is carbon sequestration, and for which the EPA is designated a new class of injection wells, Class 6. And Texas is trying to get primary permitting authority to give out permits for Class 6 injection wells. And Commission Shift and some allies are putting together a coalition to fight back against this, to stop it. There's already a coalition in Louisiana fighting primacy there. But, you know, just given the terrible history of the Class 2 injection program, we don't think the state needs any more authority to screw things up. I mean, hopefully they'll do a good job, but I'd like to see proof before we risk our lives.
To that end, you know, we've talked a lot about the Railroad Commission in particular, other state bodies that are really, you know, taking a role in this. But one of the things that I wanted to ask is what is the responsibility of drillers in this? You know, I mean, some of these sites obviously are so old that they've, you know, swapped hands many times, that companies that originally built them no longer exist. But, you know, purely in your view, what is the responsibility of the oil and gas industry to addressing this issue, if they have one?
I think good companies want to do right. Every good operator that I know knows bad operators, and they want them out because they're giving everybody else a bad name. I hope that makes sense. But, you know, companies who go and drill a well have an obligation to plug it. I think anybody would agree with that. You know, you can't just go around poking holes in the ground and saying, oh, well, not my problem anymore, you know, when things start gurgling up. That's just not being a good steward of our natural resources. And that's the entire purpose of the Railroad Commission, is to be a sort of steward and watch over the natural resources of Texas. And they're supposed to make sure that companies do that. And I think most companies want to do that. But clearly we've seen through the structures that are in place and through the sort of predatory transfer process and, you know, failure of adequate financial structures, that we have a terrible orphan well problem in here in Texas. And until, you know, we have leaders step up to do something and change it, it's going to continue. And it's going to continue to get worse as the consequences become more severe with bigger wells, with bigger volumes, and with more dangerous outcomes.
Thank you.
I mean, I don't have an opinion to offer on how responsible oil companies are in this. I mean, I think that is a matter being hotly debated in courts over who is responsibility for it. Are some of these wells on people's land in the Gulf of Mexico? Mm-hmm. It's a matter being hotly debated at the policy levels. And yeah, I think it's especially important, this conversation, in light of the carbon capture.
Mm-hmm. You want to say more about that, or?
Well, carbon capture involves injecting a heck of a lot of carbon underground, and there's billions being invested on that at the moment. And, you know, it's talked about as a major component of the fight against climate change. Mm-hmm. But as part of that, there needs to be a conversation of how to safely trap carbon underground. And these issues with migration of produced water, it raises questions about how the oil companies, how the policy folks, how the regulators should go about handling this, handling carbon storage.
No, and I appreciate that. I appreciate you bringing it to policy as well, because it does get at many of these environmental issues. Just, they are immensely complex, right? This is a well on someone's property that was drilled by a company that now is under the regulation of a state agency, that, you know, there's multiple competing interests of whose responsibility is this. Of course, different people are all going to want someone else to be taking care of the problem, which is why it's being contested in courts. And we're not talking about something that happened last year or 5 years ago. We're talking about issues that have existed for 120 years, which means this is a deeply complex question of responsibility, of ownership, even literal ownership. But then how do we resolve that, and how do we make sure people are safe?
Right.
Yeah, it's complex. This issue of liability, we were seeing it at the last legislative session, looking at proposed bills that would limit liability for disasters in the case of CO2 plume migration or escape, you know, pipeline rupture. So I think the lawyer community, the legal community, is certainly aware of like what liability means and how important it is in the financing of these projects, right? If it's determined that, you know, you're going to be responsible for this plume migration if it acidifies this underground aquifer in 50 years or 100 years, and you're going to have to pay to, you know, clean that up or pump in water or whatever, that's going to really change the business calculus of whether or not the projects happen. And I don't think that liability, all of those liability considerations have been clearly defined yet. So, you know, for that reason, we're seeing a lot of gray area in this space, and there are a lot of unknown variables. But to me, that's really the crux of the issue. Really well-defined liability that places the burden of responsibility on the operator, because if it's not there, then it gets defaulted to the people of Texas, right? Orphan wells are now the responsibility of the people of Texas to plug through their taxes, et cetera. And so, you know, you look at this industry that's made a lot of people here really, really wealthy, and we're all so proud of it. But, you know, this is our opportunity to take some of that capital and do the right thing to ensure that we have a safe future for oil and gas, for drilling, for sequestration into the next 100 years or more.
Thank you. We are rapidly approaching the end of our hour here. So before I let you both go, I just want to ask, you know, are there things that you want to make sure we know that I haven't gotten to? And really critically, are there ways the public can get involved around this issue?
Just one other point on the issue of carbon capture, that the orphan wells themselves are a liability for the future of, mm-hmm. of carbon capture, and that seems to be something that everyone acknowledged when I talked to them, is that it's easy enough to avoid orphan wells that they know about. You know, when energy companies are plotting out where to store mm-hmm. carbon underground, they can avoid wells that are known. But when you're dealing with these undocumented wells that no one knows about, that's a liability for everyone.
Absolutely.
Anything else I think folks should know? I would just direct you to our website, commissionshift.org, because we have a lot of information on all of our great programs. You know, we're working on waste pits. I think right now you can sign our petition to have stronger waste pit standards. There's new rules coming out at the Railroad Commission.
You want to throw a quick definition of a waste pit?
Oh, waste pits. Oh, that's an open pit full of mystery sludge.
Oh, so what it sounds like.
Yeah. You know, it's basically where stuff is left to sort of evaporate or burn mm-hmm. off in an open pit. And so there's a question around, should they be lined, or is unlined okay? It's just sinking into the ground where it came from. But, you know, I think the bigger issue, one of the things for me is this sort of like proprietary mix of chemicals that we don't know what it is. And we know that PFAS, right? Mm-hmm. I don't even know what it stands for, but
forever chemicals
are going to stay in our soil and get into our, you know, groundwater. And so they're becoming a part of us. And so we really need better oversight on waste pit management. I would say that's, again, another no-brainer. I love the work that we do at Commission Shift because it just seems so like accessible across the aisle. You know, everybody can get across, like, you know, responsible regulation of waste pits and plugging orphan wells and changing the name, for goodness sake.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much to both of you for being here. I'm so delighted by this conversation and getting to learn from you both and hear about what you've been working on. I want to switch really quick to announce a couple of events that are happening this weekend. Paige, you were involved in starting as well, so I'd really love to give you the floor. But there's the Greater Houston Environmental Summit on Friday and the Houston Community Climate Summit on Saturday, both at the University of Houston downtown. And Paige, can you tell us a little about what's going on with those?
Yeah, I'd love to. So the Citizens Environmental Coalition is having their summit. It's like a half-day networking event for folks who are in the environmental community that want to see each other and have some lunch and hear some table talks and stuff. So that's, I think, $50 tickets are still available on Eventbrite. Check out cechouston.org. That's going to be at UH downtown from 12 to 5 on Friday. And then a partner event on Saturday is the Houston Climate Movement Community Climate Summit, which is also going to be at UHD downtown from like 9 to 5. And there's going to be keynote presentations from Juan Mancias of the Carrizo Came Crudo tribe and Matthew Tejada, the director of environmental justice at the EPA. There's going to be community breakout sessions to talk about sort of issues in your community and brainstorm potential solutions. That's a free event with lunch and childcare and Spanish translation provided. So check out both of those great events from Citizens Environmental Coalition and Houston Climate Movement.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. We have a quick segment from our other researcher, Sienna Yen, on ways to get involved coming up here in Houston.
Hey everyone, this is Sienna coming to you with some upcoming opportunities to get involved. The Houston Audubon's Bird Week is happening this week with events ranging from today through Sunday. Houston Bird Week is a celebration of the important role Houston plays in the journey of billions of migratory birds and the everyday lives of our resident birds. Houston Audubon and local conservation partners have arranged a week full of virtual and in-person events centered around our region's birds and wildlife. From birding opportunities and watch parties to bird walks, beach cleanups, and more. With a multitude of events each day, there's something for all people to enjoy. On Saturday, September 30th, from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. as part of the Bird Week, the Houston Audubon is hosting a beach cleanup at Bolivar Flats Shorebird Sanctuary. Your efforts will help prepare the sanctuary for the thousands of migrants coming through during spring migration and help provide clean habitat for the beach nesting birds. Houston Audubon will provide gloves, grabbers, trash bags, and water. Just be sure to dress accordingly for the weather and sun protection. You can check out and register for these events by going on Houston Audubon's website, clicking Programs, and then Houston Bird Week. Most events are free, such as the bird walks and bird-friendly planting sessions. But some events, like Bike and Bird and Birdie Yoga, are only $5 per person. Again, register for this amazing week of events on Houston Audubon's website, or by simply looking up Houston Bird Week. Take this opportunity to not only get involved in your community, but to also connect with nature. I hope you guys have a great and wonderful day.
Thanks, Sienna. Finally, today from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. here on 90.1 KPFT Houston, we'll be broadcasting the live stream of the 2023 Houston Mayoral Forum on Animal Welfare. Tune in. You do not want to miss it. Up next time here on Gulf Streams, the environmental history of Houston. Why is Houston where it is? How did the city grow into the sprawling metropolis that we know today? And as the city evolves, what can we learn from our past development that might help us plan better for the future? If you have questions or ideas for what you'd like featured on Gulf Streams, leave a voicemail at 713-348-4081 or email me at westont@rice.edu. Gulf Streams is a co-production of KPFT Houston and Rice's Center for Environmental Studies, with support from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation and the Rice Sustainability Institute's Eco Studio. Produced by Weston Twardowski, co-produced by Joseph Campana. Audio engineer, Rico Henriquez. Research support provided by Jaden Bray Boyce and Sienna Yen. Stay tuned for the R&R Show with Ronnie Renfro and Tom Richards here on KPFT Houston.
KPFT is supported in part by Rice University.
Hello, KPFT listeners. This is Interim General Manager Sandy Wyman with some information about today's schedule. This afternoon at 3:30, we will be airing the Houston Mayoral Candidate Forum on our HD1 channel. John Whitmire, Sheila Jackson Lee, Gilbert Garcia, Robert Gallegos, and Lee Kaplan will be squaring off in this pivotal debate. Listen in so that you can be informed when you make your choice and cast your vote. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
This is Steve Earle, and you're listening to KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.